This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. It was known as Japan Inc., a tight-knit fabric of social, political, and economic order that offered workers job security and middle-class lifestyles in exchange for hard work, loyalty, and strict family discipline. After World War II, Japan Inc. made tremendous strides toward becoming the world's leading economic industrial power. But when the economic bubble burst in 1991, things fell apart. Since then, the pressures of global capitalism have shattered that order. Today, about a third of all workers in Japan are temporary workers without job stability or benefits. It's affecting not only jobs, but the way Japanese people relate to one another. More people live alone than ever before, and the value of the nuclear family is declining. Ann Ellison is a professor of cultural anthropology at Duke University. She studied Japanese life after the bubble burst and is the author of the new book, Precarious Japan. Ann Ellison, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Talk about life in Japan before the bubble.
Yeah, well, you mean post-war Japan.
Post-war Japan, yeah.
Before the end of war was a different Japan, too. Well, as you know, Japan built up remarkably quickly. By 1968, it was already having double-digit economic growth. 70s, 80s was this period of incredible prosperity. But people also moved from the countryside to the cities and started working really hard if you were a man, started mothering really hard if you were a woman, and started studying really hard if you were a kid. And there was a social contract. You know, you work hard, and then you get security for life. And that's kind of what people came to expect. Not that that was necessarily easy or fun. You had to work really hard, and there were certain kinds of expectations and extractions that you had to be willing to give. But nonetheless, you had a certain kind of promise that you would have enough money to own your own home, have a car, maybe take a trip overseas, and that you would have respect and social status, and you'd be able to get married and have kids.
Yeah, and these roles, as you point out, were quite distinct and very well defined. Men worked, women raised the children, and kids studied hard. Right. Talk about the way that it all worked together, and yet those were very well-defined roles.
Yeah, I mean, what does work mean? I mean, did it work? I mean, it worked if you were willing to do that, if you were willing to conform to that kind of standard. And not everyone either was willing to do that or could do that. So, you know, people, I think, now are very nostalgic for that period of time in Japan, too, which is one of the things that I write about in the book. There's this incredible melancholia for that which they had and presumed is now lost for most people. And yet there were always people who were precarious. There were always people who, you know, again, either couldn't or wouldn't put up with those standards. Kids who didn't test very well, as you were just talking about with your previous speakers. Or women who couldn't have kids or couldn't, you know, didn't want to get married. People who were gay, you know, and didn't want to be heteronormative. So there were always, it was a very rigid model. But nonetheless, if you were able to do that, you would have this sense of belonging that you had made it. You were the middle class. People, 90% of people self-identified as part of the middle class.
And yet they weren't. Let me stop you there, because not everybody was the so-called salary man,
right?
This didn't apply to everybody. Because it was the topic of all the discussion in the 70s when the U.S. was worried about losing its status to Japan, and looking at the model and saying, well, these people work 24 hours a day for their company, and they salute and say, give me some more. But that wasn't everybody.
Well, it wasn't everyone. I mean, not everyone was a salaried man. But that kind of salary man ideology pertained. I mean, everyone kind of thought that they could do that. And so not everyone had lifetime employment. That's true. That was a pretty small group of people. But everyone felt a certain kind. I mean, the ideology, the reigning dominating ideology, was that you stay loyal to your company for the long term, even if that wasn't exactly life. And same thing with marriage. You stick it out. I mean, I had friends who stayed married and never talked to their spouse for 15 years because to get divorced was this incredibly stigmatized prospect. And so, not everyone adhered to that, but that was kind of the reigning ideology.
Yeah, and as you say, 90% identified as middle class, and yet they all didn't really reap the benefits
That's
equally.
Right.
And it's conflated with, or all of this is tied up with, your loyalty to the company is the same as your patriotism about your nation.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. There was this incredible patriotism that you wind up realizing and enacting at this everyday level of your family and your work and your schoolwork. And yet you thought, I mean, I spoke to men in the early 80s who would say, well, you know, I'm working on the weekends and working late shifts. Why are you doing that? Well, I'm doing it for my company. I'm doing it for Japan. So absolutely, there was this conflation between this everyday notion of being working for your family and then working for the country. And that, too, has all kind of split apart.
And what's key in all of this is that that becomes, if you're talking about your family, your country, and your job, that's a pretty big part of your identity,
that's
who
right.
you are. It's
exactly.
not just what I do, right?
That's right. No, exactly. Yeah.
And so if
yeah.
that if that starts yeah. to come apart, we
right.
can see what might happen. So let's talk right. about kind of step by step.
Sure.
You refer to the precariat in right. your precarious Japan. What
right.
do you mean?
Precariat is a word that was first used by French and German social theorists and Italian social theorists in the 70s to refer to people who are irregularly employed. So you don't have the security of a regular job, which actually, if you think about it, refers to most people around the world today. So precariat actually refers to those countries where having a regular job with security was part of the expectation. So places in Western Europe, Japan, United States. So precariat are those people who don't have that, but also have some notion that they should have that, or they could have had that, or their parents had that. So there's also incumbent upon that is a sense of loss. Well, I could have had that. My father belonged. Well, I don't belong because I don't have what my father had.
So what's happening in you know, during in the years of Japan Inc., when everything held together and this ideology dominated, if you didn't have a regular job,
right.
if you were temporary, what was your status?
Yeah, pretty low.
Yeah.
Pretty low. I mean, it kind of depended. There were always self-employed people. There were always renegades. There were always mavericks who might work for an American company or would invent something. So, but if you were kind of the lower echelon, you were a lower echelon. You were, you know, stigmatized. Japan remains and was certainly then a very hierarchical society. I mean, democracy is a democracy with a notion of hierarchy that is incredibly longstanding. So people who did the best were the people who had the best kind of jobs, the most lifetime employment jobs, who had the family with the kids, who were also reproducing that very model. So if you didn't have that, you were pretty stigmatized.
Right. Things are steaming along pretty well for Japan. It is a world cut in half by the Soviet Empire and, you know, competing with the Western world. That all falls apart in the late 80s and early 90s, and the bubble bursts in
That's
Japan
right.
at the same
right.
time.
Right, right. Well, the bubble burst about 1991. And even before that, there started to be a little bit more flexibilization of labor. The end of the 80s, young people, sometimes very purposely and out of choice, decided to reject this model of being, you know, tethered to the company as their mainly their fathers had been, or their mothers. You know, women thought, you know, to be a mother in Japan also means that you have to work incredibly hard. You don't have a lot of choice and freedom in your own life. So already there was starting to be kind of a liquefaction of that model. But in the 90s, it became more by fiat. You didn't really have so many choices anymore.
As we see more people with irregular work, what's the fallout? You report on some remarkable phenomena in Japan, social phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's complicated because I don't try in the book to merely say this is all caused by a change in the economy, because I think some of this has been caused by the incredible rigidity and competitiveness of that prior model, which now gets glorified because it's slipping away and it's no longer within the access for many people. But what you find is, you know, you find a lot more people living alone. You find that the stitching between the family and the job has kind of fallen apart. So a lot of young people say that they want to actually have a family and get married, but they can't because economically they don't have that regular job. you find a certain kind of malaise. I mean, that's in part what I mean by precarity. I call it social precarity. I mean, there are various words in Japanese that talk about a sense that, you know, people will say they don't have an ibasho, which means a place where you feel comfortable. And a lot of people say, ibasho ga nai, I don't have that. And it doesn't necessarily mean a literal home, because sometimes they do have homes. They might be living at home with mom and dad and staying within one room because they feel that they can't leave that room. Now, what is that? Is that, you know, psychological? Is it social? Is it economic? I mean, usually for people, and the word is hikikomori, as you have mentioned before, people who withdraw into their rooms, often those people are middle class, because you have to actually have parents who have money enough that they can afford to have you be non-productive and unemployed and not going to school for years, which is what sometimes happens. So there's a whole concatenation of what we could call social pathologies. And that's, in fact, how a lot of Japanese feel about them. I mean, what's happening? Some people say Japan is falling apart. You know, the stitching. Again, it's not just the economy. It's kind of the social tethering of people to one another into place feels like it's rupturing.
Well, what's fascinating is it was never just the economy. So when you have tightly stitched fabric, you break apart one part. A global economy that requires people be paid less and not so much job security. The whole thing falls apart. Hikikomori, tell us more about this. These are kids who literally can't leave the house. How widespread a phenomenon is this?
You know, it's really hard to document, because hikikomori, by kind of very definition, are people who have lived not communicating, and that's the key word, not communicating with humans or face-to-face communication, withdraw usually into a room in their parents' house. The mother will make food and put it outside the door. The person may go out in the middle of the night to 7-Eleven to get a manga, a comic book. Often starts around ages 12, 13, which is a period of intense studying for entrance exams into high school. 80% male. So it's much more, males are much more vulnerable, which is an interesting question, because of that kind of competitiveness, which they're feeling both, you know, squashed by and threatened by and perhaps incapable of being able to realize. And sometimes it goes for years. You might start as refusing to go to school, might slip into full-blown hikikomori, and it may go for years, it may go for decades. They say there are people who are in their 40s and 50s who have been living entombed in a room, because my understanding of it, what I've read, is that it's not a happy thing. You don't choose to do that. You are living pretty isolated. You might be doing social media. You might be doing video games. So you might be somehow communicating digitally. But it's not a happy state or condition. Reports are maybe a million. And what I hear is that it's going up. It's not going down.
In a nation of about 128 million. So that's a big number. More people are dying alone.
That's right, which is another phenomenon that I study in this book that some people have said is not the most upbeat book, although I do think that there's something hopeful in what I try to see coming out of these conditions of precarity. Yeah, there was a report about 3 years ago that said in 2009, 32,000 people had died all alone, which means, and the phenomenon is either lonely death or solitary death, is also that the body is discovered days, sometimes weeks afterwards. And so these are people who have been living alone, and one-third of Japanese do live alone. In fact, a lot of Americans live alone, which I wasn't aware of. I think about one-fourth of Americans live alone. But in Japan, if you're isolated from what we've been talking about, those social relationships that kind of tether you to a sense of well-being, if you're isolated from that, you don't have anything.
Well, how does it reflect a change in family relationships?
Oh,
were family
absolutely.
More close-knit, and would that have been a scandal to allow a family member to die alone?
Well, I mean,
because it's not in this country. Frankly, it's not a scandal.
Well, and I've, Well,
should be, but it's not.
No, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know quite how to answer that, because, people are scandalized. When you heard, when the show came out and was mainly about lonely death, I spoke to a lot of people who said, oh, my God, you know, what has happened to Japan? And also, it's mainly elderly. Well, there used to be incredible filial piety. So it's a scandal, and yet it's happening. It's happening. And in part, funeral mortuary postmortem care is incredibly expensive. So in part, it's another, to get back to global capitalism, it's an issue in part of money. But then also, if you have been isolated from your family, and again, lonely death happens much more to men, middle-aged, elderly men who have sometimes lost their jobs. So in part, it's a shame thing. They leave their family because they can't provide for their family. And then when they die and someone calls and says, oh, did you know so-and-so died? You know, the family says, well, I'm not going to claim the body. I mean, we've been estranged for 20 years. So I'm not going to put them in the family plot in the Buddhist temple and pay for it. And so, yeah, in answer to your question, yeah, it kind of goes back to family. And family kind of goes back to the economy. And ever since the end of the war, family size has gone from extended to nuclear, which also means that there's a lot of pressure placed on the family to become the de facto welfare unit. I mean, the family has to do all this stuff. And, you know, a lot of families kind of implode. They don't have the resources, human, financial, to take care of all their family members.
So what is being done, apart from waxing nostalgic about a time that may never have existed?
Yeah, no, there's a lot happening. There's a lot of political activism. I mean, we haven't talked about 311. We haven't talked about the nuclear disaster. I mean, in fact, a lot of people are protesting that, which is interesting. And there are a variety of kind of social initiatives and agendas. Some young people, I mean, when I say young, they're more youngish people in their 30s who are activating for irregular labors, some for hikikomori, some for suicide. Suicide is also pretty high. I've attended Stop Suicide events, which I see as a form of activism. People who are unrelated by family or work are trying to reach out and restitch the notion of social membership and social relationality. So you find efforts. I think they're still fairly minimal at this point. I think the future will be really interesting in Japan.
It's a fascinating study. Ann Ellison, wish we had more time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank. This has been wonderful.
Ann Ellison, a professor of cultural anthropology at Duke University. The latest book, Precarious Japan. She's going to be giving a book talk at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on December 3rd at 7 o'clock. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.